already acclaimed in boardrooms the world over, How the Deal Was Done brings together the most interesting and candid dealmakers in investment history. And now, How the Deal Was Done, with your host, Laura Quinn, founder and CEO of 29 Bison.
Welcome back, everyone, to How the Deal Was Done. Today, we are diving deep into a critical yet frequently underestimated aspect of M&A, employee benefits. Joining us today for this conversation is Tom Inglesby, a principal at Birch Benefits who brings a wealth of experience in navigating the complexities of benefit plans during acquisitions. He and Pat and their team are of particular benefit to us in addressing the particular needs of the mid and lower middle market. Birch helps us tremendously in bringing value across virtually all of the clients we serve, whether 50 or 5,000 employees. Tom, welcome to the show.
Awesome, Laura. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Tom, you and I were chatting recently about a situation you encountered where a company's initial approach to benefits in a buy and build strategy went kind of awry. Can you set the stage for our listeners and tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of the times that we're getting involved in some of these companies from an M&A these buy and build platform deals is really when they're either making their first acquisition or they're looking at merging a few different firms together. And we're getting involved to help set that strategy from how can they scale, you know, whether they're making, you know, a couple more acquisitions, 10, 20 more acquisitions. So how do they really look at it from a, how are they digging into benefits? And a lot of times we see companies, and this company in particular, I think it was IT services roll up, they really wanted to get in and say, hey, we're going to build out these really rich benefits packages, and we're going to build out really strong contributions. And one of the issues that we saw in that one in particular was that they were in a fully insured arrangement, and you know, they merged a few firms together, and they set their strategy a little too aggressively. And what I mean by that is they wanted these Cadillac plans, but they didn't take a step back to look at in these markets of these 50 and under acquisitions, 100 and under acquisitions, you can do as much benchmarking as you want, but they really run the gamut on what kind of benefits they're offering from a contribution model, from a contribution side, as well as from a plan design side. So we work with companies to say, how do we set that, you know, kind of benchmark those field goals, those goalposts, and expand them? And this company did not really expand them. And they started acquiring these companies. And a lot of times they were rolling in companies that were 10 to 15 life acquisitions that were costing them $100,000, $200,000 because they had really set their schedule, their contributions and their plan designs a little too aggressively. And they weren't fully aware that some of these acquisitions aren't going to be as competitive as them in the marketplace. So that's one of the red flags that we look at when we're really setting these strategies and making sure that we avoid that from a constriction standpoint.
What's the initial conversation like when you're spending time with these portfolio company leaders, particularly as they're moving through diligence before closing? Right? There's that period where you're trying to understand what are the two organizations offering, what's the right plan design, what should these business leaders be looking at? What should they be thinking of when they're putting plan design together? And how should they be thinking about, you know, the best intention is I want to take care of my employees. I want to do the right thing for them, which is laudable, but there are impacts to that. How do you engage in that conversation with them?
I think it's kind of talking about what we just talked about. It's like, hey, here are the red flags that we've experienced in, you know, in doing a bunch of these acquisitions, setting up the platforms. And it's really, how do you set the platform up to scale? Whether it's, you know, again, a lot of these acquisitions, there's no data from in these under 50 acquisitions, these under 100 acquisitions. So that's one of the issues that we're running, that we've run into, and is just an issue for some of the small groups in our, you know, from a carrier's perspective, they don't get much data. So it's really, one is, how do you set this up so you can scale with many different acquisitions? So it's really a plan spread, a contribution spread that creates true choice, whether you're acquiring somebody that has rich benefits or someone that does not have rich benefits. And then the other side is how do you set the right funding mechanism from a from you know fully insured captives consortium self-funding whatever it may be, but how do you set those parameters and kind in risk mitigation tools, things like stop loss that you can avoid the potential of lasers because you don't know what you're acquiring on the other side. So a lot of times we're really digging into what's behind door number two and how can we set these up that we're not coming across a claim and having a laser of a couple hundred thousand dollars, things like that.
Okay. I'm super interested to hear your thoughts on the language and the jargon that gets used in this space. I mean, very often we're spending time working with investors, business owners, portfolio company leaders who don't have expertise in the world of benefits. Let's talk first about the data you were just sharing with us. So when we're discussing things like lack of access to data, what data are you talking about, and why is that particularly important to this population of decision makers?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the data, we have underwriters on our team that are taking in data, medical data, prescription drug data, and really projecting that forward, looking at things like trend, credibility, and sorry, I'm getting into the industry jargon, but really what I guess at a high level you need to know is really there's, a lot of these acquisitions and these bolt-on acquisitions are in this 0 to 1 to 50 employee range or 50 to 99 range. That's majority of our middle market platform deals. They're buying smaller companies. So what the issue with the industry in that market is that they have access to very little claims data from medical or prescription drug data. But once you start acquiring companies and you start getting above 100 employees, you're going to be rated from a stop loss standpoint, from a premium standpoint. More based on your claims. So as you do get bigger, your specific claims start to matter more and more. And I think that's another red flag that we often see people, an issue that we see people think is, and logically it makes sense, is that if you have more employees on the plan, you're going to have lower rates and premiums. Again, that's not always the case, and that's something that we see people you just assume in our space a lot. But it's really what are the claims? Once you start getting over 100, you really start need to know what are your claims, what are your medical claims, your prescription drug claims, and that's what we work with a lot of the portfolio companies on. How do we manage that? Put in things that can help lower those claims. Put in things to help lower your fixed cost on a monthly basis as well. So. So I think it's really how do we get access to the data? And sometimes in these small acquisitions, it can be really tricky.
Which brings to mind a situation we've been dealing with a relatively recent acquisition, a platform acquisition, small group, plus or minus 25 employees. And one of the things we heard from this platform company leader was the cost of their benefits, and he was really struggling to understand why their benefits against other similar organizations seemed so high. And one of the things we learned doing some digging, and it was something that they, as the employer, didn't know, is that they had this catastrophic claim that there was an individual in their employ, and actually the employee, not a family member or dependent, who it is on an organ transplant list. And so I bring this up because sometimes you just don't know, particularly if you're inside of, another group insurance plan, or you're coming out of a PEO plan, you're not seeing your individual data. And then all of a sudden there's underwriting happening, and this kind of thing pops up, and it impacts things like the lasers you were talking about. So can you talk a little bit about what a laser is? Why is it really important? And are there schemes or opportunities for reducing what the impact of lasers are for an organization?
Yeah, definitely. That's a great question. So, what a laser is really in the stock in the self-funded world, you are breaking apart three different components of a fully insured plan. Really, you're paying for your medical and prescription drug claims. You're paying for your stop loss, which is going to be protection above a certain threshold, And then you're paying for, a TPA to approve and deny claims on your behalf, have access to a network. But in that stop loss world, a laser is really, if everybody in your plan has a $50,000 specific, deductible, so they're going to pay the first $50,000 for every person. But we know that John Doe has a cancer claim that we're projecting $500,000 a year. They might laser that John Doe at $500,000. So you'd pay the first $500,000. Where this becomes really important, especially in these specific to these platform deals, is if you have clean data early and you can get into a no new laser provision with a rate cap. So we do some work with captives, consortiums in the space. But if you can get into a policy that has a no new laser policy in perpetuity, as you continue to scale, these policies can pay off, massively down the road, because it's not really if you're going to have a claim, a $500,000 claim. It's just a matter of time at this point, and it's going to happen. We always say there's a lot of groups that we're talking to where they're saying, "Hey, we're running great, and we should be fully self-funded on our own, whatever it may be." But it's just a matter of time, and we've seen it kind of. If groups can get into those policies early, it can significantly pay off down the road.
The world of medical coverage and health and welfare benefits, including ancillary benefits, right, has changed significantly over the last decade or so. As you think about counseling and educating your clients, what are the things you are bringing up with them as they begin thinking about their renewals, for example? What are the areas of opportunity that often don't get thought of in a corporate boardroom, and what's changing that organizations should be thinking about?
Yeah, I still think the prescription drug side is a massive opportunity. We recently found, had cases where we found a million and a half dollars of savings just on the prescription drug side alone. And if you're looking at that from a PE, perspective, and they're, trading these companies at 10, 15 times EBITDA, it's significant money there, So, and that's what gets us. That gets me really excited about working in this space, is like we love to kind of uncover some of the savings opportunities on that side. So I'd say that the prescription drug side is a big one, and it's I think it's just going to be even more and more so. You see a lot of this stuff coming up across the country. There's a the lawsuit with J&J and the Wells Fargo one, kind of the fiduciary responsibility on that side. And we saw drugs that they were paying, allowing to pay, $10,000 that they could have got for $100. One was like $3,500 that they could have got for $110. So, I just think that there's still a lot of opportunity in that side, especially in this middle market, really 100 to a couple thousand employees, in that space. So there's a lot of ways to ring, kind of ring out the towel in that space.
Are there things around not only plan design, but eligibility criteria? I know you and I had the opportunity, our teams together, to work with a client of ours, looking at, for example, how many Medicare eligible individuals were being covered on the plan, and that particular organization hadn't really thought through the education around Medicare enrollment and assistance in those kinds of things. Are there those kinds of opportunities or other similar opportunities employers should be thinking about as they're putting in place employee communication, employee education, coverage for spouses, all of those kinds of things? I know that some of those costs or the impacts can be incremental, but depending on the employee population, those incremental costs can add up over time.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think, we especially specific I think you're spot on with the Medicare. We do some work with a company called Smart Connect, where they are really advocating and educating folks on how to get on Medicare, what are the plan designs, how would it benefit them. So there's a ton of low-hanging fruit there. The other area that's popping up, and there's a lot of things that are there's a lot of kind of bipartisan support on this with ICRAs is going to be something that's really interesting, which are really individual plans for employees administered on a group platform, but they are also essentially selecting individual plans. And one of the things that's really interesting, specific to these buy and build platform deals, is if you can class out employees by location, and you are classing out populations that might have a high claimant that would be coming onto a self-funded plan, implementing things like ICRAs are really interesting. Again, it's kind of if you can get the data ahead of time and understand what is kind of coming onto the plan, how can you get creative to not take away benefits from employees, but to really properly de-risk both populations.
I love that. That's great. I know you and I, in talking about some of the changes in the industry overall, have also talked about, I'll call it, some of the administrative components of cost saving, and we were talking about auditing. Talk a little bit more about what that looks like and where you're seeing organizations benefit from going through claims auditing.
Yeah, this is, and again, it's something else that we're monitoring closely. We're really excited to roll this out to a lot of our self-funded clients. And it's really, how can you, with the elimination of gag clauses in the CAA, that allowed essentially employers to go back and dig into what their claims were. How can you audit and make sure that you are properly being charged or have the ability to audit a claim above certain thresholds? So essentially, if a $50,000 claim pops up, your TPA can flag that, go in and audit it, and then really pen the claim, work on it on the back end, and approve or deny the claim or approve it at a different level. And we think that there's a ton of opportunity there in this self-funded space where there is tons of waste and abuse in this area. So really getting in, digging into challenging bills and auditing, just making sure that they're being paid properly. I think there's a huge opportunity there.
That's great. I know, again, over the years, we've had conversations about what does industry benchmarking look like in this space. It's very typical for us to hear, particularly for first-time investors in an industry or a market, to come to us and say, I understand comparing two plans together when we're looking at a buy and build strategy for a portfolio, but how do I know whether or not we're at market or above market from a benchmarking standpoint around our benefits? And that's difficult, particularly in a market like we were talking about earlier, where there just isn't a whole lot of data. It's even difficult to get your own data, much less get the data for others. Which makes it even more difficult to find benchmarks. What's your advice to investors and to portfolio company leaders as they think about what's the right strategy and design as you're thinking about things like attracting, retaining talent, particularly in circumstances where it might be a really tight hiring market? You're looking at, I mean, even still, we're at 4.2% unemployment, which is technically right around the fully employed level in the United States. How do you advise your clients around this benchmarking and knowing whether or not I'm doing the right thing or we're investing in the right thing?
Yeah, no, I think you're right with that. I think that there's a way to set the benchmark, but then again, it's like if you have the goalpost, don't get so caught up on the goalpost. You have to expand those early and often, in our opinion, because these acquisitions, some people might not be offering any benefits. Some people might have 50 people and they might cover 100% of the benefits. So I think you just want to set yourself up to a point where you're agnostic whether the company has no benefits. We've seen MEC plans and ICRAs all the way to self-funded plans that are covered 100%. So I think you just need to set a proper option, menu of options that it's not going to, hurt you or really put you in a bad situation, whether you're acquiring a company with rich benefits or lesser benefits. And I think, it's not as much of getting caught up in this is the perfect benchmark for our specific niche and industry as it is like that's a great baseline, but let's expand it just so we don't get caught off guard and again be that person that has to you're making a 15 life acquisition and it's costing us $350,000 of benefits. Like that's wild to to see when you get caught. You don't want to get caught in that situation.
Yeah, we've seen it, we've seen it both sides. We've seen circumstances where employers haven't offered benefits at all, and then are struggling at the, just before they're moving into the close of the deal because there's a massive EBITDA add back because the cost of covering benefits in the new phase of this organization has to consider offering benefits because the platform company offers benefits. And that wasn't necessarily a consideration. And there's some financial implication in the deal closing that has to account for all of those things. That can be a very difficult conversation for business owners and operators. And the same goes the other way around. We have certainly seen circumstances where, in lieu of top dollar salaries, higher benefit offerings, because that's what the employees either needed or demanded at the time, were being offered. And now you have to pare that back because the larger employee pool now has different needs or their geographies demand something different. And there are all kinds of implications for that kind of expansion.
Yeah, no, I think the other thing too is everybody's so focused on like the perfect integration of all these companies, but sometimes you have to just step back and just make a business decision. Does this make sense for us to jam this through? And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't, right? It's just, you have to look at that, treat them, each as individual acquisitions. But I do think everybody gets really wound up with like this has to be all integrated and before we can bundle it up and sell this thing. But there are times when it just doesn't make sense to force it through, to be honest.
Yes, yeah, we've seen that as well. I mean, and there are certain circumstances where, because of the structure of the deal, you have more latitude. In an equity situation, you could potentially leave employees on an older plan for a period of time before you think through integration, and it gives you time or latitude to do something different or choose multiple plan designs depending on the population or the kind of employee, the overall total rewards philosophy or what have you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Tom, as you think about this year, 2025, and kind of moving forward, are there pieces of advice you like to share both with investors and with business operators and platform or portfolio company executives that you think help to them to benefit themselves and their employee population around benefits overall? Stuff you want to make sure that they're considering as takeaways.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, and I know that we laugh about this, that like benefits and HR diligence and the work that we do is not top of the totem pole sometimes when they're talking about how, what diligence we're doing for these acquisitions. But I think the biggest thing that really what we're passionate about is understanding what are the financial implications. And like we have case study after case study that are, $1 million, $1.5 million, $2 million, that it's significant money when you're digging into the benefits and kind of carving out some of this fat. So again, I think there's a ton of value to be had here. And the folks that we've worked with, I think, pick up on it pretty quickly. So it excites us. We love this space and you've helped us, learn a ton in this space as well. So, yeah, it's something that we're kind of just trying to get our proposition out there.
Those are really good points. And one of the things that we always ask and we look at are the human components, being a steward, a good steward of the treatment of employees as they're going through these transitions. And very often that can mean understanding, for example, whether or not you have a complex claim sitting inside your employee population. And does that mean that you need to identify that claim or that claimant and then have an advocate or make sure that there's a bit of additional handholding happening through the process so there isn't a coverage continuity issue, or, you know, there has been some pre-approval for a drug or something that is medically necessary for an individual. And because there's a switch happening inside of the benefits, some individual might have an issue obtaining the medication or the treatment, or, you know, there's a surgery scheduled that's critical. We very often make sure in the diligence process that not only are we working on the things that you've been talking about, but also working alongside the HR team and the benefits administrators, and sometimes their brokers directly, and saying, okay, what do you know about this population that we should know on a person-by-person basis just to ensure that these things don't fall through the cracks? Because, you know, that's a lot about building trust for the employee population and their families with the acquiring organization. But also, I mean, these are human beings, and we want to make sure that they are being treated and shepherded through this process in the best way we possibly can. And you only know that by asking a question and kind of digging deeply into some of that nitty gritty. And, you know, we don't often come across huge issues, but when they do happen, they're big and they're hairy and they are complicated, and, you know, people's lives can be at risk because of it. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, awesome. Tom, any parting words? Anything else you'd like to make sure you're leaving our audience with? It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, no, likewise. This is an area that we're super passionate about. You know, we continue to put more and more resources in this space and want to continue to find different ways to drive value, to work in these, you know, platform M&A deals. And yeah, it's something that, you know, we'd love to connect with anybody in the space. We've got some good case studies that we'd love to share with people.
Fantastic. Tom, how can people reach you?
So our website is birchbenefits.com, and follow us on LinkedIn. We're pretty active on LinkedIn and try to get as much material out there as we can.
Fantastic. We are deeply grateful to you and your entire team for your thoughtfulness, for your generosity of spirit and sharing vital information, both to our clients directly and to the audience of this podcast. Take care, everyone. Thanks for visiting us on How the Deal Was Done.